On Tech News Today, Facebook virtually says something real about Oculus Rift. Google's Ingress might become a TV show, and BlackBerry posts a profit. We've got great journalists from Mashable, VentureBeat, The Information, and The Verge, so stick around. Tech News Today is next.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
It's time for Twit's annual audience survey, and we want to hear from you. Please visit twit.tv/survey and let us know what you think. It only takes a few minutes, and your anonymous feedback will help us make Twit even better. We thank you so much for your continued support. twit.tv/survey.
This is Tech News Today for Friday, March 27th, 2015. This episode is brought to you by Shutterstock.com. With over 49 million high-quality stock photos, illustrations, vectors, and video clips, Shutterstock helps you take your creative projects to the next level. For 20% off image subscription packages on your new account, go to Shutterstock.com and use offer code TNT0315. And by Casper, an online retailer of premium mattresses for a fraction of the price, because everyone deserves a great night's sleep. Get $50 off any mattress purchase by visiting casper.com/TNT and entering promo code TNT. Tech News Today is the show where we talk about the tech news with the journalists who report it. I'm Mike Elgin. Welcome to the show. And joining us as co-anchor is Mashable senior tech analyst Christina Warren. How are you doing, Christina?
I'm good. I'm good, Mike. I am recently returned home from a trip to see Bob's Burgers Live, which was very exciting.
Yes, and I heard about that. I heard about that on Twitter. That sounded really cool.
It's a lot of fun.
And speaking of things that are live and things that are dead, Meerkat, guess which one that one is, has already been caught up to by Periscope. And if we have that chart, we can throw it on the thing. This is devastating. It took about 10 minutes for Twitter's Periscope to meet Meerkat in terms of, what is this, tweets per day.
So I guess we should start calling it Schrodinger's Meerkat.
Yes, we should. Yeah, Meerkat is, you know, the interesting thing, though, is what I've discovered is that you get a lot more viewers on Meerkat, at least you can.
Yes.
But it takes longer. With Periscope, you pretty much get a rush of people right at the beginning, and then it trickles off pretty quickly. This morning, I saw one YouTube star who was doing a Periscope session, had like 900 people on the first 10 seconds, and then after about a minute, she was down to like, you know, a fraction of that. And whereas with Meerkat, you start out with 3, and then you get 4, and then you get 10, and then, you know, after about 2 hours, you have, you know, 200 people or something like that.
Yeah, no, I used Periscope yesterday, actually, on my drive home. I was in an Uber coming back from Penn Station, and Periscope had only been open for a couple of hours. And so I decided to kind of do that. And we had like 45 people watching me in the back of an Uber talking. But it was certainly less interaction than what I was used to seeing on Meerkat. But as you said, I mean, those numbers are showing that people are already – I mean, it's already surpassed Meerkat's numbers. I think that the difference is that, you know, the integration with Twitter is almost a two-edged sword, right? Like on the one hand, it's great because you can get a ton of people signed up super quick and people can be notified almost instantaneously. But then the reverse is that kind of that initial kind of early adopter community that is kind of built up around Meerkat isn't necessarily going to be there around Periscope. So I think it might take longer for people to kind of have the sustained interactions just because right now anyway, and I think this will change, but right now it seems like the user base is a little bit different.
Yeah, it is a little different. It's also nice that they don't use Twitter for the messaging. They use the app itself so that the you know, people's Twitter feeds were getting weird with all these conversations that made no sense at all if you weren't watching the video.
Exactly. And I also enjoy the fact that, you know, when it saves it for the replay, that the likes and the conversations are part of that replay. Whereas on Meerkat, if you save it to your photo stream, you know, you basically just have the video and you lose out on all that interaction. So when Mashable was at the Game of Thrones premiere earlier this week in San Francisco, we were Meerkatting with people on the red carpet. And the only way we were able to capture kind of the Meerkat experience of what happened is we literally had to have our managing editor, Jonathan Ellis, was watching the Meerkat on his phone, and his girlfriend, Allie, was recording the Meerkat stream with her phone. She was recording Jonathan's phone with her phone. And that was the only way we were able to kind of capture that entire experience. And so, you know, I think that that's a positive, separating it from kind of the Twitter stream and also, you know, saving that conversation as part of the video itself is super nice. Oh, and saving the stream period, I think is really nice. I mean, that's obviously the biggest differentiator right now other than the kind of the some of the other user interface things. I will say one thing I do appreciate about Periscope, I was able to, and I don't know what this says about them. I mean, obviously they've got the user numbers are already surpassed, you know, where Meerkat was, but I was able to secure the username at Christina on Periscope. So, hey, I'm Christina on Periscope and on Vine. Now on Twitter, there's still somebody who's just squatting on that one. So I'm out of luck there, but I was able to get Christina on Periscope. So that's pretty exciting. I'm not Christina on Meerkat. I have to be Film Girl on Meerkat, but I am Christina on Periscope.
Wow, that is very cool. All right. Well, why don't we jump into the news? I got the Periscope people are getting antsy here talking about Periscope. They want to hear about something else. Let's jump right into it. Oculus chief scientist Mike Abrash gave a long keynote yesterday at Facebook's F8 conference about how the human brain will be tricked into believing what it sees in virtual reality. He also gave a few more details, very few, about the upcoming Oculus Rift product. Dean Takahashi is the lead writer for Games Beat, Adventure Beat, and joins us now. Welcome to you, Dean Takahashi.
Mike, thanks for having me again.
Thanks for being here. Now, did it make sense to you that Abrash yesterday spent his time on stage talking about and showing optical illusions? How did this benefit developers?
Well, he had to entertain them while he did not deliver any news to them. Everybody is sort of waiting to hear when Oculus is going to ship on the desktop. People think it's going to be this year, but he really didn't say that. Facebook's CTO didn't sort of help that situation when he said just before Abrash went on stage that you're going to be able to have these experiences this year, but then they had to sort of backtrack off of that that comment. So Mike didn't really have anything to talk about except science and sort of the theory of virtual reality and what reality really is. He just sort of reminded us of this famous quote from The Matrix by Morpheus, that real is just electrical signals interpreted by the brain. And so he played a bunch of mind tricks on the audience to show that that this really was true, that your brain sort of is not really translating direct reality to your mind. It is interpreting what it sees and changing it to fit something that you recognize. And that was pretty interesting.
So in addition to talking kind of about what is reality and getting kind of kind of avant-garde with stuff, he also, you know, showed off the Crescent Bay demo, which we've seen before, but he was talking about it. And can you talk a little bit about that Crescent Bay demo, specifically the need and the challenge of refreshing at 90 hertz?
They've been working with the same set of components for a couple of years now to cost reduce them, and they're going to try to sell this thing for, you know, $200 or $300. Moore's Law is helping them, but it's still pretty expensive. And so they can produce images on a screen at 90 times a second at 90 hertz. And they have a somewhat, you know, sort of more limited field of view than you do when you're really looking at the world at 280 degrees field of view. They think they can get to reality as we perceive it. Right now, you know, the images are not perfect. They're sort of HD quality, but we see at better than that quality. So what was interesting was he pointed out where Crescent Bay is as a technology and what reality is. But what he didn't say, and he really sort of should have addressed, was, you know, what's the sweet spot there between these two, where 90% of the people are going to say, you know what my brain is showing me right now is real, and that, you know, it's good enough quality. And I think that's sort of the big question facing them is, you know, like, they've got their prototype now, they've got reality. Where exactly do they need to hit in order to give us something that so that virtual reality seems real?
And speaking of real, Dean, what is Facebook's teleportation?
Teleportation was an interesting demo that Mark Zuckerberg showed on the day before in his keynote, where it's basically a live stream of a video of some other place. I did the demo, and I could see Facebook's campus in Menlo Park from San Francisco. And I looked around at 360 degrees, and I could see everything. So I could see a video that was live streaming into me of what was happening live on the Facebook campus in 360 degrees. So anywhere I looked, I could see what was going on based on it was connecting to a 360-degree camera that they had set up in the plaza of Facebook's headquarters.
That's cool. I hope Apple does that to their new headquarters because they have a 360-degree building. That'd be cool to plunk that right down in the middle of the spaceship. Dean Takahashi is at VentureBeat.com, and you can follow him on Twitter at Dean Talk. That's DeanTak. Thanks for joining us today, Dean.
Thank you.
The Information is reporting that Google might be working on an Ingress TV series. The site says Ingress developer Niantic Labs has partnered with the Sean Daniels Company, which is the producer behind Sci-Fi's upcoming miniseries, The Expanse. What's really interesting about this news is that Niantic sees the TV show having an influence on actual gameplay. Tom Doten is a reporter for The Information, and he co-wrote the exclusive with Amir Afradi. Tom joins us now. Welcome to you, Tom.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
Glad you're here. Now, before we get into your story, can you talk about what Ingress is and where it came from?
Yeah, it's a skunk. Niantic Labs is kind of a skunkworks project inside of Google. It was started a couple of years ago, sort of as a way for Google to placate one of their top talents, John Hank, who was a top executive at Google Maps, and he basically started this project within the company, which is Niantic, and then Ingress, which is the game, and it's a so-called augmented reality game. So it kind of layers on this virtual world into the real world. And so the way the game works is that, and, you know, we'll have to simplify it because it gets, you know, pretty complicated, but essentially you as an individual go out into the real world and find actual landmarks, that, through the game are, described as portals. And there's kind of a battle between two opposing teams as to control over these portals.
So how might the TV show actually influence gameplay?
Well, so that's the interesting thing about it all is, excuse me, is the way that this is sort of being discussed with the creative team is that this is all supposed to be part of the same world. It's all very early stages, but the way that they're viewing it is the sort of elements in the TV show could inform gameplay. So clues that are in the show, characters in the show, even maybe the producers of the show or whatever, could sort of be incorporated into the game. So rather than it being just a spinoff or some kind of a, Marvel, separate universe, this is all supposed to be part of this continuum of reality and augmented virtual gameplay.
Now, can you tell us a little bit more about the project, its current status, and who's involved in it?
Right. Yeah. So, it's kind of a convoluted set of circumstances that has Google as a producer on the show. But basically, because they own Niantic and they own Ingress, Google is sort of a de facto producer. But they've partnered with Sean Daniel Company, like you mentioned, which is behind this sci-fi show that's going to be coming up in later this year. And they also have a history of working with other video game properties. So they kind of have a track record of working with niche genre fiction and trying to turn it into some sort of a TV show or TV property.
Really interesting stuff. Tom Doten is at theinformation.com, and you can follow him on Twitter at City of the Town. Thank you so much for joining us today, Tom.
Thanks so much.
All right. An exclusive on The Verge by Spencer Woodman says that Amazon makes even temporary and seasonal warehouse workers sign an 18-month non-compete contract. Spencer joins us now to talk about it. Welcome to you, Spencer.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Now, how did you learn about Amazon's employment contracts?
So I actually applied and was accepted to a job as a seasonal warehouse
Congratulations.
Worker. Thank you. Back last year. And I did not take the job because of this incredibly restrictive contract. But I was able to keep a copy of the contract, and that's how I first learned about it.
So Sorry, I totally lost my place. So the contract prohibits workers from working for any company that is directly or indirectly supports a good or service that competes with Amazon. But basically, Amazon sells everything, right? So basically, it prohibits you from working anywhere.
Right. I mean, I think that's certainly an interpretation that would jump out at, you know, most people, I would imagine, that read it immediately. I mean, Amazon has gained the title of the everything store because of the incredible breadth of its goods and services. And so, right, and the contract is also very explicit that its restrictive covenants, its non-compete clause, can extend across the entire globe. And Amazon is, of course, a global seller and is continuing to expand around the globe. So the wording of the contract is quite far-reaching and very strict. And the non-compete clause is just kind of the one clause in the employment contract that we were focusing on in this article. But if you go through and read the contract, I mean, there are a lot of pretty striking elements of the contract, especially given that, you know, these are hourly and temporary workers who have been signing it. For instance, there's one clause that says you must show a true and correct copy of this entire agreement to any prospective employer before accepting employment. There are several clauses like that you know certainly would jump out at you as a bit strange to be pushing on hourly and temporary warehouse workers.
You know, and a lot of their workers are seasonal. For example, they have these enormous holiday seasons where they need tons and tons of workers to send all those packages people are ordering as gifts. And so this contract, this non-compete clause, extends to the off-season so that those seasonal workers can't work in the off-season unless they work at something somehow completely different from what Amazon does. Now, what is Amazon afraid of here exactly? How do they benefit from forcing $12 per hour employees or preventing them from working somewhere else?
I think that's a really good question, and that's a question that we did ask Amazon. Amazon did not respond to our request for comment. But one of our questions was, you know, what's the motivation for pushing this contract on hourly and temporary warehouse workers? And, you know, I think there are a lot of different possible motivations. The very cynical explanation is it's an attempt to deprive the company's competition of a section of the unskilled labor pool. So just basically making it harder for competitors to hire people for their warehouses. The more benign explanation would be that Amazon is very concerned with secrecy, and these warehouses, you know, could arguably contain trade secrets that even low-wage workers are exposed to. But, you know, these jobs have been well documented as requiring little training and very little skill. We don't know what the motivation is for the company requiring this contract of workers, and or whether, you know, it's a uniform contract that everybody at the company has signed, and they just kind of said, okay, sure, let's have the warehouse workers sign it too. In terms of their motivation, it's just speculation at this point.
Are you aware of any other companies that are doing the same sort of thing, or is this something that you think is unique to Amazon, at least to this context? Because I haven't heard of any other companies that are taking this strong of an approach, especially to, you know, to hourly employees. Are you aware of any other companies that go this far when it comes to their non-competes and their NDAs?
Well, back in, I believe it was October, the Huffington Post reported that Jimmy John's, the sandwich chain, was pushing a non-compete agreement on its permanent workers who, I believe, had some kind of management roles in sandwich stores. I mean, I believe these were hourly workers at Jimmy John's, and that agreement apply to sandwich sellers within 3 miles of any Jimmy John's location, and there are a lot of Jimmy John's out there. So somebody crunched the numbers, and it turned out to be an extremely broad non-compete agreement. So, I mean, I think that's one of the most prominent examples we've seen so far. There is an article in the New York Times, and the AP has done some good work. These publications have found that non-competes certainly have ensnared low-wage workers before and have been enforced against low-wage workers before. Hairdressers, nail stylists, agricultural workers, and things of that nature. So this is not completely novel, but potentially, given Amazon's sort of scale and influence, I think it could be argued that Amazon is a bit more of a powerful and more influential company than Jimmy John's.
Very interesting. Spencer Woodman does not work at Amazon.com. He works at TheVerge.com. You can follow him on Twitter at Spencer Woodman. Thanks for joining us and telling us about this today, Spencer.
All right. Well, thanks a whole lot for having me on.
All right. Got some more news for you. All right, take care. Got some more news for you in just a sec. But first, let's talk about Shutterstock, the place to get great images. How many images? How about 49 million? Try those on for size. They're easy to find because they've got amazing search. You can search for moods, emotions, colors, company names, anything you like. It's fun to just go in there and search all of these images. And, of course, they add a ton more images all the time, 370,000 every single week. And so it's just a great site to find anything you're looking for your project, whether it's a blog or website or an ad or whatever it is you're doing. Shutterstock.com is a great way to find those images. I use it all the time for blogging. Sometimes I have hard to illustrate concepts, and you always find conceptual photography in there in greater numbers than I could ever even fathom. Here we're looking at a lot of fruit. Thanks for that, Jason. A lot of pineapples and bananas. An infinite supply of fruit pictures. So check that out. You can try Shutterstock today by signing up for a free account. You don't need a credit card either. Just start an account and begin using Shutterstock and find out what your next project could be like. You can also save your favorite images to a Lightbox to review later, and you can share those as well. Once you decide to buy, use offer code TNT0315, and new accounts will get 20% off image subscription packages at Shutterstock.com. And for 20% off on new accounts, use offer code TNT0315. And we thank Shutterstock for their support of Tech News Today. Google lost an appeal in a British court today over tracking browser users and now faces a lawsuit there. A group called Safari Users Against Google Secret Tracking, that's the name of the group, accused Google of overriding security settings in order to track users via cookies for contextual advertising. Christina Warren, that's got to be the most boring group meeting ever. A bunch of Safari users complaining about Google.
It has to be, but I also have to say I kind of love the name Safari Users Against Google Secret Tracking. There's just something so direct and hilarious about that. So well played to them.
And of course, Google, this is the incident that keeps on giving for Google in 2012.
Yes.
The FTC fined them $22.5 million. That's lunch money for Google. But in 2013, they paid another $17 million to settle a U.S. court case. Now it's going to the U.K. And what's interesting about this is Google said, hey, if you, UK law doesn't really apply to us. We're a California-based company, so sue us in California. And the UK court says, no, we can sue you under the UK Data Protection Act, and now they will be sued. So we're going to see this whole thing drag through the courts again, but this time in the UK with the funny wigs.
Yes, it's interesting, too, because I'm curious, if obviously, their fines in the U.S. are, they make that money back in a few minutes. So it really it doesn't play any hand on them. But since the UK courts and the European courts in general tend to be their punitive notions tend to be less about money and more about putting restrictions on what Google can do. I wonder if there's going to be anything, that might limit what Google can track or anything else. It'll be interesting to see the outcome of this case, especially now that the lawsuits can go forward.
Yep, absolutely. And it could be a little bit of a risk. That could be why they really wanted it to happen in California rather than the UK, because who knows what those people are capable of or whatever. I don't know what they're worried about. But it can't ever be good to have all that stuff in court. Well, in product update news, a new update to Instapaper adds a speed reading option and also an option to save text as an image to Twitter. Christina, do you ever do that? Do you ever grab the screenshot of the text to overwhelm the 140 character limitation?
Sometimes, yeah. And it's interesting that they did this because, you know, an app just came out called OneShot, I think it's called, that basically lets you, you know, take a screenshot of text and highlight a certain part and then share it. And Instapaper's latest update basically includes that feature built in. So, you know, that's kind of become a popular way of sharing text on Twitter, is to kind of take a screenshot of something, of an article or a comment, to go beyond just the 140 characters and highlight the pertinent bits. That's what I think one of the interesting things that Instapaper and frankly, all of the BetaWorks projects are kind of good at, is that they'll see something cool out there and they'll find a way, hey, can we implement this in our own products to kind of, you know, give rise to it. So I actually think that's a pretty clever feature to add.
Yeah, me too. And I'm a big Instapaper user too, so I expect I'll be using that. All right. Well, Google and Bitnami launched today a new feature for Google's cloud platform, enabling developers to deploy more than 120 open source applications to the platform with just a few clicks. These include WordPress, Drupal, Redis, MongoDB, GitLab, and Django, a bunch of others. This sounds like a really great new feature, Christina, because it just adds a huge convenience to something that's really a pain in the butt to do.
Totally. And I've used Bitnami's service before to deploy things to Amazon. And I think they also have, you know, some things that make it fairly easy to go to other services like DigitalOcean. But I think having this, you know, with Google and making it so easy, literally one-click cloud deployments is great, because, like you said, so oftentimes, you know, with a lot of these applications, it's a pain to have to set up the database. It's a pain to have to kind of go through the automated install process. And if you can just do it with one click and have, you know, a cloud instance on a server set up and everything configured properly, it's great.
It really is. Well, in another story, YouTube is cranking up the video quality so high most PCs can't even handle it. The latest extreme is 4K video at 60 frames per second. I tried this morning and it crushed my MacBook Pro with Retina. Absolutely crushed it. Now, and when you're looking at this right now, this is 60 frames per second, what I'm seeing, according to Alex. We send out our video versions of the shows at 30 frames per second, so you won't really see the full frame rate. But why the heck are they doing this, Christina Warren, when hardly anybody can see this stuff?
Well, I think it's interesting because, you know, they were actually a really early adopter of 4K. I mean, they adopted 4K, I think, when it was the Red cameras were the only ones that could do it, and you really didn't have any monitors that could even play it back. I think it's just about them trying to embrace what they see the future at being. And it's more likely, I think, probably that more of us will have access to 4K displays, probably, I'm not even joking here, on our phones and tablets than we will on our laptop screens or our television sets. So I think it's just, you know, adding support for that extreme version shows that Google is serious about really wanting to kind of stay ahead in the game. I kind of wish that they would maybe focus some of their efforts a little bit maybe on bitrate quality rather than, you know, supporting, you know, the highest resolutions possible so that, you know, they actually look as good. I still think that services like Vimeo look a lot better than YouTube in terms of the quality because they have, you know, their larger bit rates. But I think this is great. I mean, it's just helping us push things forward so that when we are all in this utopian future where we've got Oculus, you know, things on our faces and you know, million 8K, you know, displays all over the place, we can enjoy crystal clear 60 frame per second 4K video from YouTube. Because who doesn't want to see a YouTube star in 4K at 60 frames a second? I know I do.
Yeah, so do I. But didn't the Hobbits look terrible at 48 frames per second? People were complaining in the theaters that the frame rate was so high that it looked fake or something.
Yes, it has an uncanny valley. No, I mean, I think that's a very real concern. And that's one of the interesting things I think that you kind of have to take into account is that whoever the filmmakers are and whoever is displaying the video, you know, needs to keep in mind how is the audience going to be watching it and how are you going to be filming it to be viewed? Because it's pretty common even just when it comes to having things at higher frame rates and higher refresh rates on modern, you know, HDTVs. A lot of times they will run, you know, at 240, you know, hertz for content that was not recorded, and it was recorded like in 24 frames per second, and it speeds up. And everything looks like it's a soap opera and it looks off. So you've got to kind of, you know, turn that sort of feature off on your television set. I think that for this to actually have any traction and to be usable, whoever's going to be filming these things and to start with, it'll probably be, you know, Nature Productions and that sort of thing. We'll need to take into account, how is this going to be viewed? And is this going to actually display the way that it needs to? Because otherwise that uncanny valley effect, as you mentioned with The Hobbit, can take hold and be really negative.
Yeah. And hobbits are kind of off-putting anyway with their hairy feet and disgusting little...
They kind of are. They kind of are. And all their New Zealand underworldness. Yeah, it's just, it's a weird thing.
It is weird. Well, in mergers and acquisitions news, Amazon is in talks to buy the London-based online luxury retailer Net-a-Porter, according to a report in Women's Wear Daily. Talks are in the early stages. Forbes values the company at $2.16 billion. This could fall through, Christina Warren, but if it doesn't, this will put Amazon in a very high-end luxury category.
Yes, it will. I mean, Net-a-Porter is a big deal, and it's a big brand, and they do really good work. And it'll I guess be maybe second only to Zappos if the acquisition does go through in terms of what Amazon has paid for certain companies. But it just proves, I think, that luxury is one of those markets, and we see this with the Apple Watch, that a lot of people kind of don't pay attention to in retail as much as they should, because it only captures a small segment of the audience, but that segment has a ton of money to spend. And online luxury is only increasing, and Net-a-Porter is proof that you can actually do the online luxury space well.
Yep, absolutely. Well, in other news, Microsoft bought the Microsoft Office collaboration toolmaker LiveLoop. Terms were not disclosed. Well, we've got more news for you coming up in just a sec, but first let's talk about Casper. Casper will send you a mattress in the mail. That's right, a gigantic mattress in the mail. You rip open the box and this thing sort of like inflates with air. They use multiple technologies to make them really, really comfortable. They use latex and memory foam. So it's really firm, but it's really soft at the same time. You got to try it. And of course, you can try it. You can sleep on it. You can sleep on it for months, 100 days, actually, before you can send it back if you want to send it back. But you're not going to send it back because it's so comfortable and so affordable. Casper mattresses are a fantastic way to buy. You know, they sell them to you in a way that makes a ton of sense. Going to a showroom seems like it would be a good idea because you get to sit on the bed, you get to lay down and all that kind of stuff. But you can't really tell in a showroom whether a bed is going to be comfortable or not. The only way to do that is to sleep on it, and Casper will let you do that. You can get a Casper mattress, $500 for a twin, $950 for a king size. Compare that to industry averages. That is a really good price, and you can save an additional $50 as one of our audience members by going to casper.com/TNT and entering the promo code TNT. That's casper.com/TNT and promo code TNT. TNT stands for Tech News Today. Of course it does. And that will get you, again, $50 off. Well, in the Human Resources Department, HTC's lead designer, Jonah Becker, is leaving the company. He didn't say why. They made a big deal of this guy at Mobile World Congress in Barcelona because he did a lot of designing for them, and they like to trot him out as a hot young designer. And now he's gone, going somewhere else. We'll see where he goes. In earnings today, BlackBerry surprised everyone by posting a profit, $28 million, but still, it was a profit. Revenue, on the other hand, came in at $660 million for the quarter, which is well below expectations. The company also revealed that it sold only 8.5 million phones in the entire year last year. If you compare that to Apple's performance, Apple sold 74.4 million in the fourth quarter alone. So they got a ways to go. And, of course, this is way down from what even BlackBerry was selling just a few years ago.
Even a year ago, I mean, they are making money, which is great. And it's great that John Chen is kind of turning the company around. But I think that it's really telling that they are absolutely becoming an enterprise software company as opposed to a hardware focused company. I think that a couple of quarters ago, John Chen made a comment that in order for the hardware business to sustain itself, he wanted to sell 10 million devices a year. 8.5 million phones is not going to do it. And most of the year was with new devices. So he can't even blame the fact that, the Z10 and the Q10 didn't sell on that. They've had a couple of quarters now with the new Passport and a solid quarter with the BlackBerry Classic, and people just are not buying the phones. They are selling the MDM stuff, and they're doing well, I guess, on the bedside. But, they eked out a profit, but revenues are down. It's interesting to me to kind of compare, the company. It's certainly no longer in the precarious position it was in 18 months ago, but if you compare it to even 3 years ago, 4 years ago, it's not the same company. And I think that, expectations have to be kind of rescinded accordingly. So they're still around. They're still hanging on. But this is increasingly becoming very much an enterprise software focused company going after a core constituency. And I argued this when the Samsung rumors were kind of swirling around earlier this year. I made the argument that they need to just get out of hardware. And I'll repeat that because I figure, honestly, if you're only going to be able to sell 8.5 million phones in a year, and we're talking about in 2015, I think that those were numbers that you know, Palm was maybe less than that, you know, in 2006, 2007, but they were at least selling, you know, in that same kind of ballpark. It's really telling that how bad the situation is. I figure just get out of hardware entirely and just focus on your software and services. That's my take.
Yeah, definitely. And also focus on security, because there's a huge demand out there for enterprise quality security. Lots of companies are getting into it. They recently announced the SecuTab, which is a secure tablet that's basically a Samsung tablet. That came from an acquisition that they had made. But security is the big opportunity, and they have a lot to offer in that space. Well, we got some big numbers for you. $2.76 billion. That's how many dollars the business messaging maker Slack is worth, according to a new funding round.
Wow.
Yeah, it's worth a lot of money. And Slack is really cool, and lots of people love it. And it's really expensive. And so we'll see how they do with that funding round. In news you can lose, Godwin's Law has come to smartphone advertising. A Chinese company is advertising its new smartphone by comparing Apple to Hitler. The company is called LaTV, and the new ad for the LaTV X900 smartphone shows a cartoon Adolf Hitler wearing an Apple logo instead of a swastika. The text on the ad says that Android represents crowdsourced freedom, while iOS represents arrogance and tyranny.
Wow. That's, wow. Wow. Somehow I think that Google's together, different together, or whatever their ad campaign is with all the different animals getting along. Somehow I think that's a better message to go after rather than having a cartoon Hitler with an Apple sign. That's offensive on so many levels. I don't even know how to respond to that, Mike. That's just, wow.
Let's hope they change their advertising campaign before they march on Europe, basically. I mean, come on. This is I don't think that's even legal in Germany. Well, we'll see how they do with that campaign. Good luck out there, China. Well, in our TNT fan of the day is Frank Riddle of Cannes, France, who posted this picture on Google+. Check it out. Multiple monitors, as usual.
Nice.
Our audience members always have a gazillion monitors. Of course, that is not the show. That is the our F8 coverage from yesterday. That was Leo on the screen. And we did that at the normal time of 10 o'clock. But hey, we'll take it. So how do you watch or listen to TNT? Just record a video or take a picture of yourself or your setup. Post it on Google+, Twitter, or Facebook, or Instagram, or anywhere. And use the hashtag HowIWatchTNT, and we will find it. Christina Warren, what are you working on these days?
Well, you know, like I said, I had a couple of days off this week, so I haven't been working on too much, but I'm just kind of preparing for the onslaught of Apple Watch news that we're going to be having the next couple of weeks, and kind of redissecting everything that's happening with Periscope and Meerkat and F8, working on some tips actually about Siri, because I've found some interesting uses for Siri lately that I didn't really know about because I haven't been using it that much, and I've come across some things that have actually made it fairly usable. So look for that article this weekend.
Oh, cool. I will. That sounds really fun. Well, thank you so much for co-anchoring today, and we'll see you next time.
See you next time.
All right. You can subscribe to Tech News Today on iTunes, and you should subscribe on iTunes, and also leave a review and let us know how you like the show. Choose your favorite way to subscribe at twit.tv/TNT. You can watch us live every weekday at 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern, 1800 UTC at live.twit.tv or on the app or browser plugin of your choice. You can find those at twit.tv/apps. If you're ever north of San Francisco, come on in and watch us as part of our studio audience, and you can follow us on Twitter at Tech News Today TV. You can also follow me personally on Periscope. Just tap the people icon and search for my name. And let us know what you think. Send an email to tnt@twit.tv or call 260-TNT-SHOW. Also, don't miss Tech News Tonight at 4 p.m. Pacific every single weeknight. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is the Tech News Today. My name's Mike Elgin. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you Monday.